You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft.
Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Thanks for tuning into Americana Music Profiles. The next episode starts right now.
You are tuned in to another edition of Americana Music Profiles, brought to you by Americana Rhythm Music Magazine and AmericanaMusicMagazine.com. I'm your host, Greg Tutwiler. Let's jump right in to the next exciting interview. Dana Cooper's lifelong passion to perform music began at the age of 2 in Kansas City, heavily influenced by his father George. He began playing in bands in his early teens and by the age of 20 had moved to L.A. to pursue a record deal with Elektra Records. Now, an impressive 28 albums later, Dana joins us to talk about his new CD, I Can Face the Truth, on this edition of Americana Music Profiles. Good morning, Dana. Welcome to the podcast.
Good morning, Greg. Thanks for having me.
Good to talk to you today. I am speaking to you presently in Nashville. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
But not your original home?
Well, originally I'm from Missouri, and I got out of there pretty much as quickly as I could, just to head out to, I did the college coffee house circuit for a while, and then I went out to California, and I was 20, and gravitated down to Texas and eventually to Nashville.
All in the pursuit of music.
All in pursuit of music, yes, sir. Yeah.
So I was reading through some of your bio, and you got started pretty early, right, in Kansas City with music or music appreciation?
Yeah, music appreciation. Yeah, I did. I got my first guitar when I was 12, and I started playing drums around the same time, and I was much better at banging on things than I was in figuring out how to play a guitar. So it took me about a year there, 12 to 13, I kind of noodled around on it, started writing some songs, and playing in, little high school bands, playing drums or guitar and singing. And, by the time I was 16, I guess I was playing the couple of the prestigious folk clubs in Kansas City, the Vanguard and the Sun Coffee House, and as well as continuing to play in bands. I kind of always mixed it up a little bit, but started playing my songs out then and mixed up with, cover songs of various kinds.
Do you recall a moment in your younger days when it was pretty clear to you this is what you wanted to pursue?
Well, yeah, I mean, right around that time, I guess, by the time I was around 16, I held on to some questions and some doubts about it, which were fed, of course, by my family and stuff, too, on and off, just they were concerned for me, and my mother in particular.
It seems to be the story of every musician.
Of course it is.
When are you going to get an education and get a real job, right?
Exactly. I understand it. The older I get, the more clearly I see the picture there for the parents. But, I persisted in it. You know, I had some acumen for drawing and for painting, and my mother's a painter, and my sister, and my mother's brother, my uncle Frank, and, you know, there's a whole line of painters and on her side of the family, and I had a painting scholarship to college, and I went for, well, I went to school about a year. I attended classes about half the year, and the rest of the time I just spent sitting under a tree playing guitar for girls. It was an all-women's Catholic college.
Oh, wow.
The year I went there, it became co-ed, so I was one of three men on campus with all these girls. And so about a year into that, I just gave up and walked away from the scholarship, which pretty much really disillusioned my mother.
Yep.
And you know, I went out eventually as soon as I could. I got out on the road, did the college coffee house circuit for about 4 or 5 months, and until I was fired from for using bad language at a Lutheran college where I played. And I was way into Lenny Bruce at the time, and how to talk dirty and influence people. And I was kind of incorporating some pretty provocative language in my shows. And, didn't bode well for,
I can imagine.
College coffee house circuit at the time. The kids loved it, but the faculty didn't.
Yep.
I knew pretty early on, you know, I was always really into music. My father was super into music. He took me to see Ernest Tubb when I was three.
Wow.
So, it was not like just going to the concert. I mean, we had to go walk for miles and get on a freight train and rode in a caboose into Kansas City. And rode a bus over to Kansas City, Kansas to see him. So it was like, it was a real big deal for my dad to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how he even afforded to do it, honestly. We were so broke, but he did. And so very early on, I'd already been into the radio and listening to songs and singing along with the radio with my dad. He got a kick out of that. And so in retrospect, I think I knew more than I realized
right.
at the time.
It
took me a while to really latch onto it and get, okay, you know, one could actually pursue this as some kind of a career.
And if I read correctly, you ended up at a fairly young age in California recording an album.
I did. I went out there when I was 20, and before I was 21, I had a record deal on Elektra Records. I actually signed the contract when I was 21. We waited to sign the contract when I went in the studio. I guess it came out when I was came out in 73.
Wow.
So I was 22 when it actually was released. But I got to work with, Russ Conkle, Leland Sklar of the Section, and a bunch of people from the Wrecking Crew, Jim Gordon, Joe Osborne, Jim Horn, all those folks. So I had the...
That's pretty big for a musician in the 70s, you know. It's not like it is today. You had to get somebody's attention, obviously.
I was very fortunate there, and... of course, I realize how little of a clue I had about any of it. And at the time, I thought, well, hell, I've read Rolling Stone magazine. I know what the music is all about. Yeah. But I got dropped a year and a half or so after that, if the record came out, and I toured the country. And, you know, I got to open for people like Townes Van Zandt and met Townes for the first time. And Leo Kottke and Persuasions and John Fahey, people like that. So it was a real interesting time for me. I mean, just it truly was. And it was devastating when I lost my deal. But about a year later, I realized that was probably the best thing that could have happened to me at the time. I was a little too wild there. I don't know how long I would have lasted at that rate. So it was a real experience, and I've since seen Russ and Leland. One opened some shows for La Lovett. He's an old friend, and he used to open for a band I had in Texas years ago when he was a college kid. So once in a while, he kindly lets me do the same for him now. And Russ and Conkle, Leland, Sklar were playing in his band, and I was in my little dressing room, and there's a knock at the door, and opened up, and there are these two guys. I hadn't seen them since that recording. But they remembered me and were so sweet and gracious. I mean, I just, really blew me away.
Yeah. Wow. That's cool. So, yeah. So you've been able to record 20 some, almost 30 records over the course of your career. How much of that has been intentional? You know, a calculated journey of sorts, or is it kind of just been this, just kind of a tumbling troubadour, just pursuing the thing that, that turned you on?
Well, I guess a little of both, really. I mean, you know, I really take a lot of, it takes a lot to put out a record. I see these great accomplishments that human beings make, you know, and achieve, and I don't understand how they do it. Mm-hmm. I don't understand how anyone makes a film, for instance, from just making a 10 to 14, 15 song album takes so much time and effort and thought. But yeah, it's all been, you know, the majority of those projects were things I did either with on my own or with my band and DC3, Nuclear Family, folks like that. And then some of them were done with Shake Russell, a handful of those, probably four or five of them, I guess, actually, over the years that we did. Playing and writing partners, and he grew up in Kansas City as well, so we met one of your teenagers there. So it's really, you know, you said something about a journey, and it truly is. I was just saying this the other day, what an interesting path it's been for me, and how fortunate I've been. I mean, I've always been able to, as down, low down, and impoverished as I might have been at any point in time, I always had music to turn to, and to do these projects, to work with such incredible musicians all my life. I mean, it's quite a thing. I learn a lot from all those folks.
We're going to pause for just a moment. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the interview.
Songwriting has obviously been a central part of that, right? You're doing all original music. When did you realize that that was going to be the thing that allowed you to record so many records?
Well, I guess, I was always so into the songwriting and loved to do it and wanted to do it so much. And I saw very clearly at the onset, just how bad I was at it at the time, how much I had to learn.
Yeah.
You know, we all set up these, you know, we have our goals, we have our heroes and heroines that we look up to and try to meet up to, you know, and so I was always doing that, and as discouraging as it was, I always would, you know, pull my boots up again and go, okay, let's try again, see if I can make it better. And but really, I guess around that time of the Elektra album, that's when I started seriously thinking, okay, you know, yes, maybe the songwriting path is going to be the way I go. In fact, I turned down a songwriting deal, it was, I was introduced to the guy I would share an office with, and, you know, this was at A&M Records, and I really was tempted to take that, but, I really wanted to be an artist, and, you know, that's one of the things I've thought back on a lot. I wonder if I had done that, you know, if I had taken that gig, I think things would have been, well, obviously any change you make will completely change your path. But, I, you know, for many years I doubted and second guessed myself as a writer. And in fact, in Los Angeles, by the time I left there, you know, I went to two different offices in one day to meet with executives, and I played music for each of them. And one of them said, your songs are too repetitious. They're just too repetitious. And I went, you know, an hour later met with another guy, and he seriously said to me, your songs aren't repetitious enough.
Wow.
And I thought I was going to lose my mind. I went back to my little apartment and tried to write a song based on what these two guys had said to me. And I just gave up. I just left LA. I said, that's crazy. I can't do this. Wow. No, that's not. So anyway, once I kind of quit listening completely to all those folks, you know, or not completely quit listening, but gauged and balanced out people's advice and suggestions a little more, and started to believe a little more and have a little stronger convictions into what I was doing. But, you know, that stuff continues on. I mean, I would think for anyone creative, it's you're always going to have some amount of self-doubt. Mm-hmm. I always am very suspicious of people who don't seem to have any.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Do you have a process? You know, does a song just hit you and you've got to sit down and get it on paper? Or is it more methodic than that?
Sometimes it's like a bolt of lightning. Sometimes it's like just, you know, you struck a match and there's a little spark. I mean, it's just, there's a lot of just building block kind of stuff. I have to have, yeah, I've got to have some, it usually comes from the music these days.
Mm-hmm.
I think initially it was really, you know, I wrote poetry, then I started setting poetry to music, and now it's more likely that I'll have 15 or 20 musical ideas in a month.
Hmm.
And out of those, I may not write anything. Mm-hmm. Or I may find a gem in there and go, I really want to pursue this. And that'll sometimes come from a line, a lyric that'll pop into my head somewhere on a walk. I take long walks every day, and that usually is your time to get some kind of ideas, rhythm mm-hmm. ideas, a lyric idea, something. And then I just start to, yeah, I mean, I've always sort of got something. I'm always working on something. And once in a while, things will, like I said, just like a bolt of lightning, you'll just, wow, I have to write this. This is coming to me right now. Mm-hmm. The music and the lyric kind of together, at least some seed that I can start developing, you know, and run with. And but really, rhythms and melodies, music, all the different guitar tunings, those things, really, I just have so much fun playing with them. And that's where I, you know, the most exciting ideas come for me.
Mm-hmm.
Out of those things. The rhythm itself might imply melody if I don't have mm-hmm. a melody, just a beat.
Mm-hmm.
Or if I just have written a few lines, I'll say them out loud and kind of, you know, different inflections and expression. And out of that, I can get the hand of a melody to kind of, yeah. I really prefer that. You know, the thing when I come up with music first, which, like I said, is usually how it is now, I have a surplus of music ideas, and that can be hard to, you know, when there's mm-hmm. something you really dig playing, and you can just sit there and just play it over and over and over again relentlessly, and no words come to you because you just kind of get so lost in the music and the rhythm. And it's like, well, what am I going to say here? That's always my big question. What is it I want to say?
So. Interesting. And the latest culmination, of course, is the record that's on the way out. I Can Face the Truth. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes, that's it.
And that's due out this month, February, correct?
February 18th is the official release date, yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And the songs on this one, were you working on this as a project intentionally, or you got to a certain point when you knew you had enough to do another record?
Well, this one's real different from, usually that's how it is for me. I usually have a collection of things, and I'm just sort of ready. Okay, now I need to get in there and do a record with, you know. And this one, I wasn't there yet. You know, I'd really, my career, honestly, was sort of just languishing there, I felt like. And the last CD I'd put out, Incendiary Kid, which I really was proud of, worked on that with Tom Utes. And again, just incredible players on there. I thought the songs were really good.
Mm-hmm.
I was on a little label that did the best they could with it. Not much happened with it, and my touring was slowing down. So for a couple of years, I'd kind of been in this, just I was still doing it, but and loving it when I could get up on stage and play, but really, you know, kind of in a quandary as to what I was going to do next.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to see, I think it was a year to the day of my mother's death, or it was right around there, because 2 days later, I went to the studio with Dave Coleman. I ran into him at a club. He was playing there with a band, his band.
Mm.
And I'd seen Dave over the years with different people, a lot of different artists. Just I loved his musicality, so I went up and talked to him. And we'd met earlier, just never really talked. And he said, look, I love what you do, too. Why don't you come over to my studio and listen to some of the things I've been producing and working on and co-producing? and see if you want to record something. We'll record a song of yours and see if you like it, and then we could talk about what to do. And it was just the perfect thing. I went in there with I Can Face the Truth, which I had written not long before that, and we just recorded the song that day. And by the end of the day, I just looked through my photos the other day on the 17th of October. Is the day we did that. I took a selfie of the two of us in the studio, and we said, we're going to do a record project. Well, it was 2018.
Wow.
And it took that long to get this whole thing going.
Yeah.
But we started, I was touring a lot, and I just kind of wrote the songs, a lot of them on the road, co-wrote some of these songs with friends of mine, Tom Kimmel, Kim Ritchie. A couple of the songs were older songs that I'd never recorded, one from the 70s and one from the 90s.
Oh, cool. Okay.
And I have always wanted to record them. It was perfect. It just fit it fit the project really well, it felt like. So, and the rest of them, yeah, I had a few more that were written, and then I just had some that were partially written. I finished off with co-writers or on my own, and wrote a couple of new ones right in the middle of the project. I know a girl wrote with Dave Coleman, and Upside Down Day I wrote on my own right at the start of the pandemic when I was out in Washington State. Played my last show and got in my car, drove home in a couple of days, just straight through. I'd slept in parking lots and, stopped at rest areas and just ate out of my ice cooler and got myself home and shut the door for, a year. So we didn't work on the project for quite a while. It took getting back in slowly once COVID lightened up a little bit, shut down again. Everybody getting vaccinated, going in again. So it was a real, I've never done anything like that. I've never been through a pandemic before. So there you go.
So do you have a plan for being able to get out and share this music? You've got a tour lined up, or how do you have anything like that set up?
I do, Greg. I've got a tour. My manager, Corinne, is just booking the heck out of me.
Yeah. And, awesome.
You know, it's real. We're starting in Texas February and March. I think for February 20th, I'm in San Antonio at the Lonesome Rose, and I go from there over to Austin, Cactus Cafe, Houston, Anderson, Fair, and a bunch of little towns like Temple and New Braunfels, and go to Fort Worth. So I'm doing that whole thing through the middle of March. Then right at the end of March, go up and do a couple of things in Michigan. Yeah, it's going to be in New England probably in the fall. I know I've got things booked up there. So all through the year, I have stuff all over the country, and
good. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, I'm just being cautious. But
yeah, sure. Yeah,
yeah.
So if folks want to hear the new record or listen to your catalog or reach out and get in touch, what's the best way to do all that?
Well, my website is always a good place for a lot of that stuff, and if my tour schedule, get on the email list to see what I've got for sale and that kind of thing. And that's danacoopermusic.com. Pretty easy.
And social media, all those outlets.
Yeah. I'm on Instagram, on Facebook, on Twitter, doing all that stuff.
Music on the Spotify and iTunes and all those places.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Thank you. It's up all those places. I'm not pulling anything down yet. Sorry.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I get it.
I know.
But from my viewpoint, it helps to educate people about what I'm doing, turn them on to me my music.
Right.
It's like, well, every way you can do that at this point, one fan at a time.
Right, there you go. Well, I appreciate it, Dan. It's been good hearing your story, and I'm always intrigued. Every songwriter seems to have a slightly different a way of approaching their craft, and so it's always interesting to hear how you guys do that. So I appreciate you sharing that with us, and we wish you the best with this new record.
Thank you so much, Greg. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks again for tuning in to this episode of Americana Music Profiles. Find us on iTunes at Americana Music Profiles and on the internet at AmericanaRhythm.com.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.